Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. In this program, we examine one of the most dynamic and diverse waterways in the world, the California Delta. It's a unique part of California's largest watersheds and home to a spectacular array of fish and wildlife that have to compete for the state's most precious natural resource, water. The demands of agriculture and civilization have stressed the Delta to what many worry is a breaking point. And the future is definitely fraught with peril for this truly special part of California. Later on in the show, we'll be joined by Letitia Grenier and Jeffrey Mount from the Public Policy Institute of California to learn about the complex issues confronting water usage effects on the Delta's increasingly fragile ecosystem, past, present, and future. But first, we're going to look at the unique geography and geology of the California Delta with Jeffrey Ludlow. Jeff is a registered professional geologist in the state and the staff geologist for the California Fly Fisher magazine, where he recently profiled the Delta's fascinating geologic history. He joins us now to talk about it. Jeffrey Ludlow, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what do we mean by the Delta? For folks that really, you know, kind of have a vague idea but aren't sure, geographically, tell us, where is the Delta?
Well, the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta sits basically at the nexus of the Sacramento Valley and the San Joaquin Valley, about in the center of the state and east of the San Francisco Bay Area. And it receives water flow from nearly 40% of the entire area of the state of California and represents about 50% of the total stream flow of the state. So it's a significant part of California. Some call it the beating heart, considering its importance with water flow up and down the state. But the term delta, you know, it's interesting when you think of that geographically, but when you think of a delta, one normally thinks of the Mississippi River Delta or the Nile Delta, and a delta that grows seaward. It enters into a body of water.
Yeah, you think of that fan shape going out into the ocean.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of like a big triangle where the apex is inland and the fan, the bottom half of that triangle, the flat base, is out away from the land. So, but it's different with this delta, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. It's what geologists call a reverse delta or an inverted delta. And so like the Nile, the point of the triangle is pointing upriver, but when you look at the geography of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, the point of the delta or the upper part points downriver, and so that's what makes this delta unique, is that it, instead of growing seaward, where the river drops its sediment into a body of water and land grows, the rivers have backed up behind the Carquinez Straits and literally drop their sediment before they get to a body of water. So it's growing upriver. It's a delta that's growing upriver, which is really quite unique amongst deltas of the world.
Yeah, and I never really thought about that before I read your article about the shape of this particular delta, but it's interesting how it works that way. Let's get into how the delta came to be, because it's a fascinating story going back in geologic time. So kind of walk us through how the delta has migrated to its present location and how it came into existence.
Sure. So before we get into the delta, what really covered the area about 750,000 years ago was a large body of water called Lake Cochrane. And Lake Cochrane received water from the runoff of the Sierra Nevada. The tectonics of the Coast Range at the time had the drainage of Lake Cochrane, which covered most of the San Joaquin Valley. The drainage of the Lake Cochrane was into the Salinas River watershed, ultimately out to the Monterey Bay. So a different location where all the water from the Central Valley used to drain further south. Starting about 620,000 years ago, there were tectonic shifts in the Coast Range. Uplift occurred, and a new outlet of the delta, or of Lake Cochrane, was formed in the area of what we call the Carquinez Strait. And you can imagine what happened when all this water was coming from the melting of the glaciers in the Sierra, and this small notch in the Coast Range near Carquinez Strait was formed. It would just have been a torrent of water that carved out a channel that really isn't much more than a mile wide between, you know, the areas of Benicia and Carquinez. So essentially that was when the current delta was born.
Yeah, it's interesting to think back about what that must have looked like with all of that water just pounding through there.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of Ice Age examples of that when you think of Lake Bonneville in Utah, or you know, some of the other Lake Lahontan in Nevada. I mean, there was torrents of water, you know, post Ice Age glacial melt that really caused a lot of massive water flow. So this is just another example of it.
And then once the delta exists there, kind of walk us through how it came to be in its current form, because the hand of Western human civilization has had a big force in shaping that.
Yes. You know, it's fed primarily by the Sacramento River, the San Joaquin River, and the McCallum River, the three main arteries that bring water down into the delta. And with this landward growth of the delta upriver, very fertile land was recognized in the latter part of the 19th century. And so farming began, but you can't farm on saturated land. So what they needed to do was build the levees up, create these island tracks, drain the water, and basically make it arable land. So the agricultural land use has probably been the you know, one of the oldest impacts that have been to the delta that have caused some of the topics that, you know, we're going to discuss.
You know, it's interesting to think about that and all of those levees. Is this an area that's, you know, actually kind of at risk for, you know, flooding and things like that that could happen if, you know, because those levees have been there a long time, and we do get, you know, atmospheric river events that can go on days and days. I always think, wonder about, like, I see lots of subdivisions going into places around the delta, and it always makes me wonder about the safety of that.
Well, the levee systems continually have to be enhanced, because what's happened with the agricultural land use and the dewatering is the land is settled in some areas as much as 15 feet below sea level.
Wow.
And so as the land settles, the levees become more unstable, and so they have to continue to reinforce them, build them higher, add more riprap, et cetera. And that's the issue that the water managers are working with and trying to stabilize the levee system. The land settles primarily because of the oxidation of peat, of organic carbon in peat soil.
And when you're talking about these peat deposits and the formation of the delta, one of the things you mentioned to me previously that I'd like you to talk about is what's called the Corcoran clay, which is important. Explain to us what that is and why it's of note.
Yeah, the Corcoran clay. Well, that's shifting a bit back to Lake Cochrane, of course. You know, the Central Valley sediments, what you see typically are alluvial sediments of silts and sands and gravels of the rivers that flowed out of the Coast Range in the Sierra Nevada. And the Corcoran clay represents what's called a lacustrine deposit or a lake deposit. It exists in thicknesses of 50 to 100 feet, starting about 80 feet below grade. And then the importance of the Corcoran clay in the San Joaquin Valley is it is the aquitard, or the separating barrier between the shallow aquifers, which are typically a poorer water quality than the deeper aquifers below the Corcoran clay, where a lot of the agricultural water is drawn from.
Interesting. And it's also important because, you know, we're seeing more and more drawing down of the groundwater, of the water levels, the water table throughout the valley system, and subsidence being caused by that. So it's interesting to note that separation between the upper layers and that lower layer by that clay. That's cool. I wonder how many people know about that. The Corcoran clay is important.
Yeah, it is. And as that subsidence occurs and the withdrawing of the water table, there's higher risk of the shallower, poorer water quality working its way through that aquitard into the lower aquifers. So.
Well, of course, one of the magical things about the delta itself is that it's that incredible interface where you have the salt water out in the bay, the San Francisco Bay and the Bay Area and the Pacific Ocean beyond the Golden Gate, and then the fresh water flowing in. And then you have that meeting of those two water types, fresh and salt. And that's also a concern because, We're worried about saltwater intruding too far inland. Could you just kind of address what causes that and what some of the issues are going on now and the concerns for the future with saltwater interfacing with the freshwater?
Well, it gets back, Dave, to the levee systems that we talked about. And as the land settles and the levees get bigger and taller and become more at risk of failure, the levee systems really prop up the island tracks and help keep that saltwater, freshwater interface further west than where the intakes are for a lot of the pumping systems that divert delta water for municipal and agricultural uses. So it's an interplay of how much water can we keep held back by the levees, which are at risk for failure due to earthquakes, et cetera. And so one of the techniques that the water manager of the state used, particularly during the summer and fall seasons when there's a lot less runoff. See, when there's in the winter, there's enough runoff that interface can get pushed west away from the pumps that transfer the water. But during the drier seasons, there's prescribed amounts of water that are released from the Folsom Dam, the Feather River Dam, and Shasta to help maintain that salinity interface at the appropriate location and away from the intake pumps.
Well, approximately where is that? Where is that interface located?
Well, it would be on the western side of the delta. The island tracks and the levee systems there are more critical than they are in other parts because that's typically where that interface occurs. A lot of the pumping systems that transfer that water are further to the south. So, you know, the further it gets into the delta, the more risk that salinity interface can cause.
This is also in a region, there's a lot of faults around there. And I know there's, you know, the Hayward Fault in the East Bay is not far away, and neither is the San Andreas, but the Hayward Fault in particular is a hazardous fault system that's not super far from the delta. What are some of the seismic risks for shaking there? Because that would also be a big concern in a large quake.
Yes, and I think that's probably the main issue that maintaining the levee system deals with is well, flooding, of course, you know, the big flood events, but as the seismic activity. You know, there's not just one fault, right? There's not just one line for the San Andreas or one line for the Hayward Fault. There are splays and series of faults that come off it. And there's a known fault called the Kirby Hills Fault that is right at the western edge of the delta. And the concern is if there's a significant enough earthquake that a phenomenon called liquefaction or ground failure will occur underneath the levees and cause them to fail. And liquefaction is a phenomenon where there's ground shaking and water, as you know, is incompressible, right? You can't compress water. And so when it's water is compressed in a shallow zone and you have soft, unconsolidated or underconsolidated sediments, that water is going to want to flow up to the ground. And what's going to go with it will be the unconsolidated or loose sediments that are make up the delta, and it'll flow with it. And so what happens is you're left with these voids underneath the ground. The ground settles catastrophically and the levees fail. So that's really the trigger that water managers and the levee engineers are dealing with is how to make sure that these levee systems are built properly to withstand a significant earthquake.
And then would there be concern from if there was, say, a moment magnitude, say, 7 on the Hayward Fault, would that impact the Delta region, do you think?
Yeah, possibly could. Absolutely.
Because we know that ticking time bomb is going to go off sometime in the next few decades.
Right. And then what happens when the levees fail is that it gets back to that salinity freshwater interface. All of a sudden, instead of being protected on the west side, it pushes inland and impacts the intakes for the water transfer systems.
And it does seem to me that the Delta region and that area around Sacramento, Stockton, that whole area there has become much more developed in recent decades.
Right, absolutely. You know, and one of the other risks that sort of compounds a topic we discussed earlier, Dave, is that if you lose that water or part of it's threatened, particularly for the agricultural use, then what that's going to cause is more groundwater pumping in the San Joaquin Valley, beneath the Cochrane clay that we discussed earlier. So all of a sudden, an impact of the delta could have a ripple effect to an impact or further exacerbation of an impact that's occurring in the San Joaquin Valley with overpumping of the aquifers.
Indeed, those cascading effects that when one thing happens, it triggers another. So that's fascinating. Before we let you go, anything else you'd like us to know about the delta? Is it someplace that you like to visit?
Oh, it's fabulous. Fishing aside, the wildlife and the waterfowl population is just phenomenal. It's really a wonderful place to go at dawn and dusk and watch grinds of geese, 1,000 strong, try and settle in for the evening. It's just a fabulous place. And we're really blessed in the state of California to have such a fabulous ecosystem, in the heart of our state.
Well, Jeff Ludlow, thanks for sharing your interest in the Delta and its geology and its geography and its fascinating geologic history and potential things that may go wrong in the future that we will all have to deal with. Thanks for joining us on Blue Dot.
My pleasure. It's been wonderful speaking with you, Dave. Thank you very much.
Thanks to our guest from California Fly Fisher magazine, geologist Jeffrey Ludlow. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at California's Delta region. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. As we continue our look at the complex region known as the California Delta, we're now joined by two members of the Public Policy Institute of California. Letitia Grenier is the director and senior fellow of the PPIC's Water Policy Center, and her colleague Jeffrey Mount is also a senior fellow there. Letitia Grenier and Jeffrey Mount, welcome to Blue Dot.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, happy to be here.
For our listeners, just start by briefly telling us, give us an overview of the PPIC and the role you play there.
The Public Policy Institute of California is a nonprofit. We're interested in bringing nonpartisan, unbiased, fact-based information to Californians. And at the Water Policy Center, we're focused on trying to solve some of the tough issues around water. And a lot of that is around not just bringing information, but also using relationships and partnerships to try to share the limited water that we have in smart ways. My role is I'm the director of the Water Policy Center, and I'll hand it to Jeff.
And my role is senior fellow, underlined senior. I've been around water for 40 years. And so my role is to help Letitia and do research, write papers, and talk to people like you.
And you were one of the founders of the Center for Watershed Sciences at UC Davis. Is that right, too?
I am the founding director. Yeah. Peter Moyle and I put that together. Yeah.
Very good. Okay, well, I'd like to start with you, Jeffrey, and Letitia, feel free to chime in at any time you want. I'd like to have you characterize what the Delta is. Give us kind of an overview of the Delta region, because a lot of us, all over the place, we hear about the Delta, but don't know exactly what that means.
Well, it's a loaded question because the Delta is kind of in the eye of the beholder, and that'll be self-evident after I finish. First of all, as a piece of geography in California, it's at the confluence between two of the three biggest rivers in California, the Sacramento and the San Joaquin River, come together in the Delta. The Delta is the tidal head of the San Francisco estuary. So this is historically the place that these two rivers dumped a lot of fresh water in, but the tides rose and fell every day, twice a day. And so it was a tidal estuary. And in its original condition, before the gold rush, it was more than 700,000 acres of tidal marsh, actually much more than that. And Letitia can chime in at some point and tell us, the amount of tidal marshland was huge in this. Now, the key is that was the historic context, which has got very little to do with what we have today. So today, it is an area that was reclaimed for agriculture starting in the mid-1800s. And so now today it is a network of hundreds of miles of channels that surround what were formerly islands, but are now holes in the ground, is the best way to describe them. They're polders, like you have in the Netherlands. They've subsided due to the oxidation of the peat soils. So you've got these 60-plus islands that are there, it depends on how you count them, surrounded by these channels. And then finally, what I want to say, the eye of the beholder, 27 million Californians have a portion of their water supply that comes through the Delta, and 3 million acres of irrigated agriculture to the south in the San Joaquin Valley, principally. So it is, for many, it is a hub in our water supply system. And in fact, some of the highest value water comes out of it and is used on farms or stored in surface water or in groundwater. So, and then finally, let me one more thing. There are people there. I mean, people live there. There are farmers there. There's some towns, character towns, that are embedded within it. And it's a place where people fish and they recreate. And so it is a place in California, which is very unique. There is nothing like it.
Leticia, can you just explain to us, you know, why this is such a diverse and rich ecosystem?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about, Jeff mentioned that this was previously a freshwater tidal marsh. That's a really unique thing to find, you know, actually on the planet. So tidal marsh means it's between high tide and low tide. And a marsh means that you don't have trees growing there. You just have plants that aren't woody. And so if you think about that being freshwater, that's sort of hard to, you know, why would you have the tide if it's just freshwater and there's no seawater in there? It's a really unique situation because of the straits. The tide water pushes into San Francisco Bay and a little bit into Suisun Bay, but doesn't get all the way in to the Delta. But then historically, before the gold rush, you had that huge area of the Delta. It was 500,000 acres of freshwater tidal marsh and then another 200,000 acres of more freshwater marsh that the tides didn't reach. So it was just a vast area, kind of bigger than you can imagine. All the farmland area up in the Delta was all marsh. And the way I used to think of it is it was the refrigerator of California. You had wildlife coming all the way down from the foothills and from all around, even from San Francisco Bay Area, to come eat. So you had grizzly bears, you had mountain lions, you had salmon. They were so thick that the early settlers, the early Europeans who came to the area said that when they would go down to the San Joaquin River, they could see backs of salmon touching all the way across the river as they were going up to spawn. So the salmon were so thick in the river that their backs were touching all the way across the river.
Wow.
Which is kind of amazing. It was an incredibly rich environment. It was so productive because there were so many wetlands and it was really, really diverse. The rivers would flood and they would flood in different areas at different depths for different amounts of time. So some parts of the central of the Delta and the Central Valley would flood, you know, several feet deep for months. Some parts would flood for just a few inches for just a little bit of time. So it was really diverse, very biodiverse. The areas right near the really big rivers had really big gallery riparian forests that had unique species there. And other parts were just straight tule marsh. A lot of Native Americans lived nearby because it was a rich area and they built their tule houses, out of reeds, and they built boats out of reeds. So it was a really important area also for navigation. You could get in there in your boats and go up and down the rivers, and the Native Americans would trade with each other. So they would go up and down the rivers and both trade materials, but also people, and they would go and meet each other and, you know, sometimes have intermarriages happening up and down the river. So it was a really, it was a hub of California, not just now in terms of how we move water around, but it's always been a really important place for, you know, both for food and trading from historical times until now.
And Jeff, could you comment on just how rich it is as a fishery and for waterfowl? Just the ecosystem richness is kind of off the charts even today.
Well, okay, it's a shadow of its former self. That's in fact, that is one of the problems. And Leticia can weigh in very more precisely on all of this. But you basically have reclaimed all those marshes, and they were the engine of this thing. They were generating the productivity that helped fuel such extraordinary diversity and rich, and I mean, species richness and productivity in the Delta itself. And then remember, the Delta was a way station for four large runs of salmon in this system, and it was extraordinary as these fish would come in and move up into the watershed, and then their juveniles would come back through. the Delta was a place where they fattened up before they left to the ocean. And of course, it was a place they passed through on their way back into spawn. And then finally, Letitia referred to it kind of as the refrigerator. Yeah, it really is the traveler's refrigerator. Think about the darkening of the skies when waterfowl would migrate through into this area. These marshes were incredibly productive. And what we have today is nowhere near what we had back then. In fact, we have something today that's very different from what we had back then. We used to joke about these changes that took place so much that one of my colleagues referred to the Delta today as akin to a lake in southern Arkansas because of the changes that have been made to it. And he always would come back and say, and I remind you, look at the fishes. It's mostly fishes that come from southern Arkansas are in there. So we made it very comfortable for non-native species to move in and take over. So it is not what it was in the past by any stretch of the imagination.
What we used to have was this vast inland freshwater tidal marsh, very unique, very strange and wonderful and productive. And what we turned it into was, you know, reclaimed it, turned it into farmland, and then had basically canals in between them, in between the farms. So it was just a completely different area. And on the edges of those canals are these tiny pieces of wetlands. And that's where, you know, what a lot of the native species were adapted to. And that's what the native species are trying to live in now, is canals with tiny, tiny bits of wetlands left. And what they used to live in was a giant wetland with a few tidal channels in between them. So it's sort of flip-flopped in terms of what they were adapted to. We actually did a paper on the productivity led by, unfortunately, who recently passed on, the late, great Jim Clern of USGS. And what we looked at was how much productivity the Delta produced before and after that reclamation of those marshes. And essentially, there was this vast productivity previously for wildlife, and now it goes to people because we've turned it into agriculture. So we've just flip-flopped it from being incredibly rich environment for wildlife, and now it's a very rich agricultural area.
Well, let's talk about water, because when the Delta shows up in the news, generally it has something to do with water policy. So, and I know it's pretty complex. So Letitia, could you just give us a sense of how water policy drives what's going on in the Delta?
What's happened with the Delta is it became the hub of how water moves through California. So the way California works, it seems like California never has enough water, but that's not because we're a completely arid state. We actually have quite a lot of water. As everyone knows, water is evaporated off the ocean mostly. It rises up into the atmosphere, moves through the atmosphere in clouds. And now we think a lot about atmospheric rivers or these storms that carry a lot of water. They come over land, and especially when they hit mountains, that water falls out of the clouds, sometimes as snow, often as rain, lands on the landscape and is collected by the landscape into rivers. Sometimes it gets caught up as snow or caught into reservoirs and comes down. So a lot of it is caught up by the Sierra Cascade Mountains and comes down in that part of California. So that's where we have a lot of water. But a lot of the people in California are in the Bay Area or in the Southern California cities. And so a lot of the water needs to come down from the mountains, which is sort of in the Northeast, and be brought down to the coast, which is more in the West, in the Southwest of the state. And then a lot of our agriculture is in the Central Valley. And so the water has to be brought again from the mountains to that valley. So that's created the need for all this infrastructure and plumbing. And we have an incredibly engineered water grid that moves the water around to the places where it's needed for agriculture and for cities. And the Delta is the hub of that system, where a lot of the water is brought down from the mountains to these giant pumping stations in the Delta, and it's rerouted into canals to be brought to these places more in the more southern parts of the state. So that's really why the Delta comes up a lot. Because of that pumping, in some places, the rivers can actually run the wrong direction, especially the San Joaquin River. So there's a lot of regulations around making sure that the environment is not harmed, making sure the Delta doesn't get too salty, making sure fish and wildlife aren't harmed, making sure that the people who need to use the water in the Delta, you know, that their water quality isn't harmed. So that's a lot of what the controversy is about.
Can you talk a bit about the mechanics of how that works, of actually diverting the water? Just give us a sense, because there are so many agencies involved in this, federal and state, moving this water around. Could you just give us a sense of the mechanics of how it works?
So the water supply system that relies on the Delta is a bit of an accident of history. Originally, back in the 1920s, California had in place a plan to build what was then called the State Water Project, which was to take water from the Sacramento River and move it south to users principally in the San Joaquin Valley, but all the way to Los Angeles, as an example. So when they set that project up, in the 20s, the Depression hit. And when the Depression hit, they couldn't afford it because they couldn't get bonds. So the federal government stepped in and took over and built what we call today the Central Valley Project. Very large project. You think of Shasta Reservoir, which stores water, routes it down the Sacramento River into the Delta, whereas it's exported by pumps into canals and delivered to various users, mostly in the San Joaquin Valley, farmers in the San Joaquin Valley. Later, Jerry Brown Sr. Decided he wanted to have his own state water project. So in the 1950s, the state got bonds this time and built the State Water Project, which is a parallel project to the Central Valley Project. So you have a federally run project and you have a state-run project, which basically do the same thing. In this case, it's Oroville Reservoir on the Feather River that stores very large volumes of water. They run it down the Sacramento River into the Delta and pump it out of the Delta and into canals all the way to Southern California. So these two projects are, this is what you hear about a lot in the news, because these two projects are basically doing the same thing in the same region. They actually have separate pumping plants, although the federal government has to rely on the state pumping plant, and they have separate storage systems, with the possible exception of one off-stream storage site where they share space. This is an accident of history, and they don't always get along, and that's actually kind of what's happening today. Is the federal government and the state government are at odds about how to manage these two systems, yet they're very dependent upon each other to basically achieve their goals.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Letitia Grenier and Jeffrey Mount from the Public Policy Institute of California as we discuss the complex issues surrounding one of the Golden State's most important regions, the California Delta. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now with our examination of the environmental and policy issues confronting California's Delta region with Letitia Grenier and Jeffrey Mount from the Public Policy Institute of California. Over the years, I've heard so many stories about trying to do more to bypass the Delta with our water. Now it's called the Delta Conveyance Project. Could you describe kind of what the latest is on what the proposals are for, moving more water around?
For the last 15 years, we've been in a fairly intensive planning, infrastructure planning process. And the goal there was to take water out of the Sacramento River and put it into a tunnel. Now it's a single tunnel, and bring it to the pumps on the south side of the Delta, so that you're not taking water out of the Delta, but basically putting it into state water project facilities just south of the Delta. There's a rational reason for this. The water quality continues to decline in the Delta. The Delta is getting saltier. And as the Delta gets saltier, it takes more water released from the reservoirs to keep the salt out. And that's basically, some politicians like to call it water wasted to the sea, but you have to have water run out of the Delta, otherwise the Delta salts up. The levee network is very fragile. One earthquake and you'd have multiple flooded islands and you'd have to shut these projects down. So some years ago, as a hedge against the future, the State Water Project, and in this case, the Department of Water Resources, backed by both Governor Brown and now Governor Newsom, have been pushing for this very expensive, very large project where they can go underneath the Delta and avoid some of the consequences of taking water out of the Delta, including the impacts that it has on species within the Delta. And as you well know, I mean, first of all, if you do anything in the Delta, there's somebody to oppose what you're doing. It doesn't matter what you're doing, but they, but the opposition to this has been very well organized and very noisy. So we don't really know what its future is, but they continue to push forward through the planning and permitting process to get this project done.
Could you maybe just characterize some of the pros and cons of that idea, that, you know, things that are good about it and things that people don't like?
Yeah, you know, here at PPIC, we've sort of regularly weighed into this thing, but we always take a neutral stance, and you'll understand the neutrality here. The decline in reliability of supplies from the Delta is it's been easy to measure. In fact, there's a lot of screaming and yelling about the decline in reliability of supplies. And there are many causes of the decline, but part of it is the decline of the Delta ecosystem. And the fishes that live in the Delta ecosystem, one of them is which is functionally extinct now, the Delta smelt, and how to manage the operations so as to reduce the harm on the environment. So that's reducing supply reliability. What's also doing it is climate change is having an effect, because we tend to get, we have this such volatile climate these days, you know, where you get it all, you get too much water or not enough water, no Goldilocks moments, nothing in between. And then the changes in water quality overall, decline in water quality, it's just getting harder and harder to get water out of the Delta. And one earthquake and you really will scramble that system. So as a matter of policy, if you want to continue to take the amount of water that you're taking from the Delta into the future with sea level rise, earthquakes, and climate change, you're going to have to build an isolated facility to make that work. And that's that tunnel. On the other hand, the other policy choice, and again, we're strictly neutral on this, the other policy choice would be to learn to live with less from the Delta. That means less water for farms, less reliable water for cities. So those are your two policy choices, one or the other. Both work. Well, you can't do both of them at the same time, but you can choose one or the other alternative. The state has chosen to take the alternative of trying to maintain reliability of supply from the Delta.
Well, recently I watched a really good seminar luncheon you guys put on in Sacramento, talking about some of the changes and challenges going on with the federal partners that the state's dealing with. And I'm wondering what are some of the really big issues going on there right now? Because we are hearing a lot more about, the federal government, we're going to send more water, you know, down south. What's really going on there?
What's happening there is Trump is, you know, trying to influence the way that the Central Valley Project, the federal project, is operated, to send more water to the farms in the San Joaquin Valley. And that could add up to, you know, an extra couple hundred thousand acre feet, which is, you know, overall a significant amount of water, but not earth shattering. The negative of that, if we don't get a lot of rain this winter, could be that the way that the two projects operate together, they are jointly responsible for maintaining water quality in the Delta. So if the federal project sends a lot of water to farms and they have some non-farm water deliveries also, then the state project would bear greater responsibility for sending the flows to the Delta to keep the water fresh for the environment and for other water users in the Delta, which are farms and cities in the Delta. Legally, that is not how it's supposed to work. So potentially the state water project would then sue the federal water project and we'd get into litigation around that. But the possible negative consequence is that the state water project would have to supply that water. So that's the potential drawback to that happening. It all depends on how much water ends up falling from the sky. So that's, you know, there's some big uncertainties that come with that situation. And, you know, we just won't know if that's going to happen until further down the road.
Yes, California's climate has always been a bit boom and bust in that regard, of periods of drought with periods of, you know, massive amounts of precipitation. And it seems like that's, you know, just getting more and more exacerbated with climate change.
I think that's exactly right. And then on top of that, the two seem to be coming closer back to back. We used to think about dry years and wet years. Mm-hmm. And I think now we can think more about dry weeks and wet weeks. I mean, that may be overemphasizing it, but the weather whiplash is becoming more of an issue, where it can be really hot and dry and then very wet with the timing of those being closer and closer together. And so we're seeing more of that whiplash causing issues with, you know, things that can happen when that occurs are things like mudslides, right? So you'll have it be really hot and dry or even a fire. And then right afterward, if you get a big dump of water, you can have mudslides or hillsides coming down, things like that. So we are starting to see with the changing climate, these events that haven't happened before, and we're not necessarily prepared for them because of that, because, you know, all of our systems are designed for things that we've observed and experienced in the past, and we're trying to get ready for things that we've never seen before, and that's really difficult.
And when we look at what's going on in the Delta, and like you said, Jeffrey, it's a shadow of what it was, but are there some good things, good stories going on there with some restoration, or, you know, ways of trying to, you know, work with nature a little more than just, you know, completely battling against it? Or there's some success stories going on there?
Well, we do have to remember to celebrate our successes now and then. And Letitia and I have watched for decades now as they have slowly been getting their act together on trying to restore habitat, and in this case, I've been calling it structural habitat or physical habitat. So you have a number of major wetlands efforts that are going on. Some at the head, for example, where the Cosumnes River comes into the Delta. There's been some very exciting work there, and the South Delta, actually, new marsh has been created there. There's a lot going on. And one of the unique things about the Delta is that the flood release valve is the thing called the Yolo Bypass, which is this massive area where you have only farms and freeways that are above it. And it conveys floodwater around Sacramento, from hitting Sacramento. But finally, we now have a better connection between the river and this floodplain habitat, where we know if you can get fish like Chinook fish, Chinook salmon juveniles out on the floodplain, you get tremendous growth of them. And the fatter they are, the more likely they are to return. So we're seeing real progress throughout the system. But I think Letitia and I would both say it's not occurring at the pace and the scale that we really need if we're going to tackle the problems of the Delta ecosystem.
Yeah, that's really right. It's very expensive is one thing to think about, and it's tricky to do for a couple of reasons. One is that there's a lot of flood risk management issues. So because the Delta is incredibly flat, that's one issue. You start to affect other people around you. So if you're going to restore, let's say you want to put in a tidal marsh, you really have to think about your neighbors who are farming next to you. You might increase their flood risk. So you might have to build a really expensive levee nearby, and you're building that very expensive levee on what is essentially peat soils. And they, you know, you might start trying to pile rocks to make a levee on them. They just sink. They're just like mush. They're kind of like a sponge. So it's expensive. There's really difficult engineering. You're increasing somebody else's flood risk. They might sue you. It's hard to get it done, and it's expensive. The other issue is the Delta is really subsided. Like Jeff was saying earlier, when you dry out these peat wetlands, they subside. Some of the Delta is, you know, 5, 10, even 20 feet lower than sea level. It's hard to restore that. What are you going to restore it to? You can't just put that historic freshwater tidal marsh back. And what, you know, you're restoring something that's 20 feet lower than the sea level, you know, than the water in the channel next to it. People have worked really hard on figuring out what you can do to restore it. You can put in a marsh. It can't be tidal anymore because the tide is 20 feet higher than it next door, being held back by a levee. So you can put in a freshwater marsh. That marsh, kind of amazingly, can actually build up peat again slowly. It can build it up about an inch and a half a year. So if you had a lot of time before the next earthquake or before the next flood, you could slowly build up that peat. It would get higher and higher and higher and higher. And it would eventually, you know, you would catch up. But unfortunately, with sea level rise, it's going to be really hard for those marshes to catch up. So scientists and others are working on ideas about how could you, you know, what's a restoration plan, or we call them adaptation pathways, of how you could restore these areas and gain elevation with them so that they can get to something resilient over time. And one of the other ideas that can work is to go from dryland agriculture in some places. Some places we actually have dryland agriculture happening, and you're still losing elevation. You're still burning through historic peat and releasing carbon to the atmosphere and losing elevation every year in the Delta. If those can go more toward rice, which is wetland agriculture, then at least you can stop losing carbon, losing elevation, and get a more stable, resilient place for the Delta, and try to get toward, you know, a place where hopefully we can be moving toward a net positive place, because as sea level rises, the Delta becomes more and more fragile over time.
And there's also some, you know, environmental concerns with the Delta, you know, as far as climate change and just things going on right now. For example, invasive species. Could you talk a bit about Jeff about that? Because there are all kinds of invasive species threats in the Delta.
Yeah. So earlier I mentioned that, you know, this, the conversion of the Delta makes it look like a lake in southern Arkansas, and it's full of fish from southern Arkansas. So what we've done, the way we've transformed the Delta, we've made it very friendly for guest species to move in, and not very friendly for the species that originated there, that were adapted to the original Delta. So invasive species is a big deal, and it isn't just invasive fish like black bass and striped bass, and then all the other fish-eating fish that are in there. You know, we also have some major invasions of weeds in this thing, aquatic weeds, aquatic plants that are like hyacinth, for example, Egeria, which are really making it tough because they fundamentally change the ecosystem when they move in. So yes, this is a place where we're constantly doing battle with invasive species because we built a system which is really great for them. I mean, it makes a nice home for invasive species, not so much a good home for native species. But as Letitia will had noted, I mean, we're doing a lot of work on restoring tidal marsh in the right places. And if you can do that, you can get yourself out of that trap that the invasive species are creating.
And what about mussels? Because they've been in the news a lot, and they are also a threat to the water system, aren't they?
Well, let me give two things. First of all, on the fish side, one of the things we've noticed, they do play a role in the reduction of salmon, survival of salmon juveniles that are moving out of the system. They mow them right down. In April and May, when the water warms up enough that they become really active, it's very tough for juvenile fish to get through the Delta and out to the ocean. So what we've noticed over the years is the fish that leave earlier and get to the Delta when it's still cold tend to have a higher survival rate and come back. But it is the problem of invasive bivalves, the best way to describe it, because there's multiple bivalves in there, and they moved in the 80s, and they started stripping productivity. I mean, all the plankton was basically wiped out, and so the source of the food web, the energy in the food web, went into these clams, invasive clams. But it's the mussels that have everybody completely freaked out because they get into water supply systems and they clog up pipes and everything else. And it's always just a matter of time till we see these things in the Delta. So yes, I want to answer your question right off the bat. Invasive species are a major issue in managing the Delta today. Whether it's for water supply, for ecosystem objectives, it's a big deal.
Looking at the future as far as you can, what are some of the biggest challenges and hopes you have for the complex region that we call the Delta? Jeff?
So I think we've just spent a half an hour giving you all the challenges without the hopes. And you're right. We have to have the hope. So for me, when I looked at it over these years, I see tremendous opportunity in parts of the Delta, particularly the northern part of the Delta, to create an arc of habitat that is friendly to native species, less friendly to non-native species, and is as far away from the pumps that are taking water out of the Delta as possible. So I see tremendous opportunity there. I have for years said, right now everybody's just at odds. Do you know what I mean? Like my goal is to defeat whatever you want, kind of politics in the Delta. There's a compromise to be made here. And I think if people would just stop and say, what do I need? And is there a compromise to reach it? So I'm hopeful that one of these days that the people who live in the Delta, the environmental groups, the water users, and the projects that run it will find what I'd call a grand compromise and say, look, it's not going to be perfect for everybody, but we're going to go ahead and move forward with a unified vision of what the Delta would look like. And right now we just fight too much over it.
Yeah, I would echo what Jeff says about the northern arc of the Delta. There is possibility there for salmon, especially in salmonids. You know, there's been a lot of work on restoring rivers further upstream, on restoring tidal marshes in San Francisco Bay. So many pieces of this really huge ecosystem that stretches hundreds of miles have been put back together. And the Delta is a piece of that, where if we put a few more, you know, chunks in this jigsaw puzzle, the salmon can probably find their way. In fact, it's kind of amazing they've held on so long, but I think they can find their way. You probably saw, I don't know if you noticed, there were some news stories that there are salmon back in the upper part of the Alameda Creek watershed. This is an incredibly urbanized watershed. I'm so amazed that they're back up there. It's a watershed I've worked on in my career. But if salmon can get there, they can recover themselves through the Delta and into that really big watershed that's huge and important for California. So I agree with Jeff. We just need to keep, you know, stay the course. And I think if people can focus on facts, you know, if we can get away from politics and rhetoric and focus on facts and partnership, we can find some ways to make some solutions that can bring the Delta back. And actually, you know, I don't know that there's win-wins in the Delta, but there's compromises that can work for everybody.
Well, and that's one of the things I appreciate. The work that you folks do at the Public Policy Institute of California is it is nonpartisan and it is looking for solutions. So thanks for that. And thanks for to both of you for sharing your knowledge about this incredibly complex place we call the Delta.
It's a pleasure to be on this call with you guys. Thank you.
Great to talk to you.
Thanks again to our guests, Jeffrey Ludlow, staff geologist for California Fly Fisher magazine, along with Letitia Grenier and Jeffrey Mount, senior fellows from the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center. You can learn more about their work at ppic.org, and you can check out California Fly Fisher magazine at calflyfisher.com. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. On our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.